Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Casterbrus podcast. Yes, with a K. Available on casterbrus.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and audio boo. It all started as a mild curiosity by these Casterbrites, and now it's turned into quite a spirit of adventure, don't you think? Listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's Casterbrus podcast with a K. My name is Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Casterbrus podcast, casterbrus.com, and the main host on this podcast. And I'm doing that thing where you say words that you intended to say in a few seconds' time. With me this week are Brian Terranova.
That's me.
And a rattly James McLean.
Is that me?
Yeah, I think that's you, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. How are you? Nice weekend, chaps?
Yes, quiet actually for me, quiet.
Okay, and James, you?
Exactly the same. I shared his weekend.
Did you?
In my heart.
Oh, I was going to say, no one invited me.
No, there's only room for me in his heart.
Okay, we'll leave that there. There's nothing heavily Doctor Who to talk about this week. I'd like to say a big thank you to everyone who retweeted and listened to last week's podcast, where we spoke to Andy Frankamalan and Sean Russell and Hannah Aisman about the Colonel Lethbridge-Stewart series of books, which I'm really looking forward to seeing when they arrive. So if you're a new listener having tuned in last week, then a big hello to you. Did you guys see that John Guiler and Paul Darrow starring in Contradiction? It's now in the App Store?
I saw about it on Facebook.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Well, I've bought it already. It was reduced from $7.99 to $4.99 over the weekend. So I took the opportunity to purchase it. I mean, I was going to buy it anyway, let's face it, in order to review it and just to ignore it, enjoy it. Because really, if you think about it, I mean, it's a movie that you kind of work your own way through, and it's getting some very strong reviews as well from on iTunes. So that's encouraging for them. So hopefully there's something extremely good can come from this. Maybe get some more good reviews and rise to the top of the charts. That would be fantastic for everyone involved, not just John and Paul, but also Rupert, who was here a few weeks ago, and Tim, who I spoke to on one of the cult casts. Speaking of cult casts as well, chaps, did you see that I've expanded the content on Casterbrus considerably? Well, I say considerably, it's only by about 400, 500 posts.
Yes, we did.
So I've had to, I basically had to cut Cult Britannia down to size. The poor sister ship of Casterbrus is no longer seaworthy, but there's a lot of good stuff in there, and it's still going to be updated. It's just not going to have its own website. Basically, it's got its own section on Casterbrus, and there is a cult cast, a podcast in there with John Guiler and Tim Follin, who oversaw and produced and did loads and loads of the stuff on Contradiction. He's the brains behind it. So if you haven't heard that already, I would encourage you to listen to that, dear listener. Chaps, we do have a kind of tentative idea for a few podcasts over the coming weeks, but we're a bit slow getting off the ground with it this weekend, weren't we? But although there's no heavy Doctor Who news, there's some interesting things we've had on Casterbrus that we can talk about today.
Right.
Okay, but we will start with news. A Welshman has said that he wants to write a Doctor Who movie, which takes us back into this old, this mad world of Doctor Who movies again, which seems to be something we struggle to get away from. If it's not a Doctor Who movie, it's a crazy casting from a failed Doctor Who production in the past. Remember the Michael Jackson thing from last year or the year before?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd forgotten all about that until I was doing some research into something else the other day and it came back to me. But yeah, so former Doctor Who showrunner in Torchwood and the Sarah Jane Adventures creator Russell T Davies was on Graham Norton's Radio 2 show on Saturday. And he, the conversation obviously turned to Doctor Who, even though he was really there ostensibly to discuss his new dramas, Cucumber and Banana. And he was, he basically was asked if he would write a Doctor Who film, and he said yes. And he went on and said that, "I think it should be in the cinemas immediately. It would be glorious. Imagine queuing up at the cinema to go and see a Doctor Who film. It would be amazing to queue up at the cinema and see Doctor Who, wouldn't it? I'm surprised no one's thought of it already. They could maybe have done that in 2013, I think, maybe for the 50th anniversary. Just just a suggestion there. What do you think about Davies talking in this tone of enthusiasm about this particular topic?
You know, I guess it's not unexpected. You know, he loves the show and he wants to see big things happen for it. But it seems like for him, it's a natural progression in his mind. You know, I've done the show. People want me to do Doctor Who. What should I do next? It can only be a movie, you know.
But makes sense. He's already said recently that he doesn't want to write any more Doctor Who. Yet he wants to write a Doctor Who movie.
Well, you know, I took that as, or at least the way I read it was on TV. He didn't want to return back to it, like didn't want to go back to that show. But mm-hmm. if it's a movie, you're talking about a whole different medium, even though they're so similar, the lines are blurred anymore, but you're still talking about a whole different medium.
James?
Really what he said, because I mean his heart.
Pardon?
I mean his heart still. So what he said is what I felt. I really couldn't add more to it. I agree. I think that's the reasons behind his logic.
Okay. I seem to remember at some point, and I can't cite it because I can't remember where I found it or anything like that, Russell T Davies enthusing that television was better than cinema. So I find this whole desire to write a Doctor Who movie to be quite strange, to be honest with you.
Well, you know what? It fits with him, though, because look what he did with Doctor Who every year. Rather than try and tell, I mean, and they're both doing it, in fairness, but rather than try and tell a series finale that was just a really good story, every year was to try and get bigger and better than the last one. And how much bigger can you get than actually doing a proper movie? And I don't just mean, you know, writing a story that they take to the theaters. I mean actually doing a proper movie.
Mm.
So it does actually make sense.
Okay. If you're certain about that?
Well, within his mind, you know what I mean? Like, he wants to do big and bad Doctor Who.
Oh, it's just amateur psychology time now, is it?
Yes, it is. Psychology hour with Brian T.
Okay. Prof. Brian T.
There you are.
Okay.
Thanks for attending.
Yeah, no, that's no problem. That's a nice couch you've got here.
Yes. Well, I keep it that way.
Yeah.
Couch with a K.
Yes.
What else? Excuse the pun. Yeah. We'll move on. Did either of you guys watch any Doctor Who over the weekend, by the way?
No.
I watched a little Brain of Morbius.
You watched the little Brain of Morbius? Is that the Lego version?
The children's version.
Brian Morbius.
Yes.
He's in class 4C. Yeah. Did you watch all of it or just a little part of it?
I watched the first two episodes and then, okay. You know, I fell asleep. So.
Okay. It's quite strange that you mentioned. Are you sure you fell asleep and you didn't get cyanide poisoning?
Either or, really. I'm not 100% certain.
Okay.
They're so similar.
It's strange that you should said Brain of Morbius, because I forgot that I owned a copy of The Brain of Morbius, a DVD rather, and I found it on top of our bedroom television just the night before last.
Oh, that's where I left it. Damn it. Can't believe it.
So that's a strange coincidence. I fancy. Now, there's not many funny moments in The Brain of Morbius, is there really?
Well, there's Could You Spare a Glass of Water?
Yes.
And probably that one.
And what a magnificent head is quite amusing as well.
When the Doctor's with the Sisterhood, and I can't think of it right now, but he had a pretty good one when he was in there, yeah. Which I realized was fun. You know, it was echoing a little bit, rather the Paul McGann thing was echoing back to this story a little bit, even in tone, which I thought was neat.
Yeah, yeah. We recently did a thing in a kind of a very wooden segue into our next topic. We did a feature on Casterbus recently about Doctor Who's funniest moments.
Was that where we were going with this?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That worked well.
No. And so in there's vampires in Venice, mainly the beginning section where the Doctor pops out the cake. There's the Loggia, more or less all of the Loggia. There's Christmas Invasion, which I didn't think was particularly funny, but it was my article, so I'm happy to go with that.
I think the cake was very funny, to be honest. But
okay.
Partners in,
the beginning of Partners in Crime, which is good. Most of City of Death, portions of Inferno, and again the Invasion, Time Crash, the Romans, and Into the Dalek. The list is notable for not including the Gunfighters. Or maybe it's sensible for not including the Gunfighters. But I was wondering, which of your favourite moments that made you laugh out loud on Doctor Who?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I agree. Like, obviously, the City of Death has a lot of very good moments, and Tom was always good with a lot of the funny moments. And it's very difficult to point out with Tom what really the best ones are, because he's so entertaining all across the board usually. But in the new series, it would easily be, what was already mentioned, the Partners in Crime scene at the windows.
Yeah,
that was a scene where I actually did laugh out loud. I thought that was very well done.
Oh, I hated that scene.
Did you?
Yes. Yeah.
I think there's only. I think it really relies on the performances, doesn't it? Because there's nothing original about it. So you basically relying entirely on Catherine Tate, David Tennant, and Sarah Lancashire playing it completely straight, because otherwise it would be absolutely horrendous, in my opinion.
You think Tate was playing it straight?
Well, as much as she does. Well, no.
Well, considering the character of Donna, I would say,
yeah.
Considering, yeah. I mean, she played it as Donna. She didn't try and overdo the window bit. True. She just played it the way the character is.
I'm finding it hard to think of moments which I found funny.
Oh, I know one that I always enjoyed. I can't say I laughed out loud. Well, I probably got a giggle out of it. But a moment that I always enjoy every time I watch it is in The Tomb of the Cybermen, when Pat Troughton grabs Jamie's hand as they go to walk in the tomb. And then he realizes what he's done and kind of like throws it aside and goes back for Victoria, whose hand he had meant to grab. Which I know that they threw in a lot of those things. They weren't scripted, you know, and I think that's great. I think if you go through Pat Troughton's era, both he and Fraser Hines, I think they threw in tons of great, enjoyable moments that were subtle. Most of them were subtle, but some of them were a little over the top, but most of them were subtle and enjoyable.
There's some really nice ones in Time of the Doctor. There's little ones that Smith plays. Like when they're talking about his bald head, and there's a line she says, "You've got what is it like ears like fins or something like or so." And he
rocket
just
rocket fins, is it?
Rocket fins, yeah. And he just smiles and goes, "Yeah," because he's really proud of it. Things like that I find funny. Is those little moments, and that time in Impossible Astronaut where he runs a list of things he wants and the jammy dodger at the end, as we've said before. Yeah. And he really wanted that. He wasn't joking. You could see in his face that jammy dodger was important. So small things like that I like.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I also the unicorn and the wasp as well. The kitchen bit. I mean, there's some funny lines throughout it, but the kitchen bit in particular when the doctor's trying to get over his poisoning is quite good. But then again, as I've often maintained, the entire episode is just a run up to the gag, the ginger beer / queer gag. So,
there's also Aliens of London, Christopher Eccleston saying he's going to triplicate the flammability of the alcohol. And that's not necessarily the funny part. The funny bit is when they call him on it and he decides to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And he goes to pass it to Harriet, and Harriet's like, could you pass it to the left, please? And he's like, okay, sorry. You know, like, such a moment to say something like that. You know, it seemed like it was a great placement to me.
Yeah. It's Aliens in London's a funny one, isn't it? Because I mean, some people might call the entire story a joke. I wouldn't be so overly critical, because it does have some merits. Particularly,
I think the story itself works really well. I think the handling of the Slitheen and their gas exchange, obviously, and the way that the Slitheen themselves, I guess I should say, dealt with their gas exchange, as they call it, was the wrong way. If they had kept the fart gags in, but made the Slitheen just like kind of like, oh Christ, you know, again, you know, like these things, like when the one said, we really got to work on these suits, this gas exchange is killing me kind of thing, that was fine. But when they were sitting there like, oh, I'm shaking my booty, or I'm squeezing out one, blah, 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 whatever. If they're acknowledging it, it was too far.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the kids at home hearing the toots, they'll laugh. That's fine. That's all they need. And that would have worked great, because the story is actually a good story.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I do think it's a good story. Any more amusing Doctor Who moments? There's a few in Sharda, actually, which obviously most people probably aren't aware of, because they haven't watched it. But there's some funny bits in Sharda, as befits a Douglas Adams. And I think probably City of Death and Sharda are definitely funnier than the Pirate Planet. Although the Pirate Planet's got some funny moments, they're kind of I think of the Pirate Planet is everything is overshadowed by the captain, isn't it really?
Yeah, Tom Baker though overshadows a lot too.
Oh yeah, he does, but he's Tom Baker, isn't he? So you kind of expect that.
Robots of Death, I think, has got some nice lines.
Oh yeah, please do not throw hands at me.
Yes. Classic example of the inverse ratio, size of the mouth, size of the brain. That's a lovely little line. City of Death, he is right. There are some good ones in there. You know, what a wonderful butler. He's so violent.
Yeah.
But everyone knows those. It's, yeah.
And I think as well,
Harry Sullivan is an imbecile.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing with City of Death as well is, as we've already mentioned with these types of episodes, is the casting is absolutely perfect. Julian Glover is so good in it. He's so offhand, isn't he? And like the arrogance of Scarlione and Tancredi is makes it even more amusing. It's almost Basil Fawlty-esque at times.
Yeah.
You know, it is interesting, too, the casting in that story, because you could easily go over the top, and yet the only two characters that I can think were a little over the top was Duggan, who was mainly a caricature of a police officer, and the scientist.
Prinsky,
Yeah, Prinsky, yeah, him. Everybody else really played it nice and straight. Well, I mean, Tom, but outside that.
Yeah.
Which is always the best way to do it.
Yeah, I think you can always tell the ones when. We said it hundreds of times. You can tell the ones where Tom Baker's enjoying himself and he likes it, because you can see he's enjoying himself, and he seems to just be give it a little bit extra. And again, with a good casting, that always helps. Julian Glover was a well respected actor, so it was good casting for Doctor Who. If looking at Andy's list. I'd forgotten there was anything amusing in Into the Dalek, and that got me thinking about the 12th Doctor series as a whole. And there is a lot of he is very good at delivering those dry lines, Peter Capaldi. And I think a lot of people don't see the humour in them because of his delivery, with the nature of his delivery, which is perhaps a shame. But maybe it's something people get more used to in Series 9.
Yeah, he had good moments. I mean, on one hand, while it felt a little out of place for the Doctor for me, I still found it to be an enjoyable moment in the Forest of the Night, when the little girl knocks on the TARDIS door and he kind of just, you know, ignores her, and she says she needs help, and he points it that way and just like shuts the door on her. You know, I got a little chuckle out of that, even though I personally think the Doctor would have helped a child over an adult in a situation like that, but. You know, I found it a good moment. I think he has a lot of good funny moments. Certainly, the first episode, which of course the name is escaping me right now, but when they're in the Italian restaurant.
Deep breath.
Deep breath, thank you. And he and Clara have that whole conversation. You know, I just love, one of my favorite moments of the whole thing was when he's talking to her that she's an egomaniac. And she says, there's more things here at stake than my egomania. And he's like, right, you just said that. You know, like that was like a complete laugh out loud moment for me. I can't believe I forgot that one. I loved that one.
Actually, in Moffat's era, there's a lot of humor that is based on kind of decontextualizing everything. Moffat taking the mickey out of his actors. Particularly their accents or their personal appearance.
Yeah.
Particularly Smith and Capaldi and Jenna Coleman. Such as Clara having a strange shaped head. Wasn't there something about her having a head was too big or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah. How do you feel about it? Do you think he should do that? It seems a bit strange thing to do to me.
It depends. You know, if the actors are okay with it and they roll with it, then in a sense, I'm okay with it. Because if they're sitting there and somebody's writing about them, they have the option to say, look, that's a little too far. I find that rude. You know, but if they're not doing it, cool, that's okay. Then you see the humor in it, you know, because Russell did it too with Eccleston in the first episode when he looks in the mirror and he points out his ears. You know, they didn't make it as obvious or as rude as Moffat seems to make it, but it was there.
Okay. Yeah, I think one thing that does make a difference is that you can point out male distinguishing features and it can benefit the actor. You do it with females, it can go against the actress because female aesthetic is so much more traditionalized in entertainment from audiences and shows.
Yeah, so, I agree with that.
You know, the big ears of Eccleston are part of his distinguishing features. If you pointed out that Coleman had big ears, that could go against her profile, her aesthetic profile, which could actually affect how people perceive her. Mm-hmm. You know, do people now look at her for her large face, which is, you know, as a joke is fun. And she was great. She was with that. That's great. But that is one of the problems, I think, between genders.
I think there's a difference, though, too. I mean, I completely agree with all that. But
I think we need to be careful, actually, because James has just established that there's a difference between genders. So next week, we're probably going to get attacked by feminists.
Oh, I don't.
Do carry on.
Okay. No, I think there's a difference in how they were done. Whereas generally when they're talking about the Doctor, they're kind of outright picking on the Doctor. But generally, and I don't remember Smith doing this, I really only remember it with Capaldi, but when he's picking on Jenna, it's like he genuinely can't see a difference between what he's describing and what she is, whereas the other people around them are kind of like, you know, they're making the faces kind of like, or, you know, what are you talking about? You know, because when he talks about that she's wide or she's old or she's this, that, and the other, like, for instance, when he mentioned that the two of them looked exactly the same age, this doctor just genuinely can't see a difference. So it seemed to me a little less insulting and a little bit more character trait of that guy that he just, of the new doctor, rather, that he just kind of sees no difference in either the two of them or just how he views the world is completely different than how he used to. So I guess my point is with her, I don't think they're outright making fun of her. I think the whole point is that in a sense that the joke is on the doctor because what he's saying isn't true at all. Whereas you can point out the doctor's big ears as Eccleston or Smith and they're true.
Maybe.
If that makes sense.
I'll tell you what, let's move this on to, because is it right to do that or is it not right to do that? Well, we also ran a feature this week called 10.2 Moments That Weren't Quite Right.
Yeah.
So, and there's a few different things in there, such as the Doctor killing an Ogron, the First Doctor going to bash a caveman's brain in, which many people have cited as early character development. Guy Crayford's amazing eye patch. The Murker and other things. What about you? Have you got anything in Doctor Who's 50 years that have disturbed you and made you feel that it wasn't working or it wasn't right?
There's a lot of it in the last few years, but I would say the Ogron thing did always bug me. I didn't have a problem with the first Doctor one, though, because I do agree that that was more characterized. Like, the place that the first Doctor was at was he was terrified for his life that he was going to be caught by the Time Lords, which at the time we were led to believe were really threatening. Even up to the second Doctor, we were led to believe that they were still a very threatening race, and he had reason to be terrified, and maybe he was going to cross a line there, and Ian stopped him and never looked twice at doing it again. But yeah, I felt a lot of the whole, and I say this as a guy who never felt that the Doctor didn't or shouldn't have relationships. I always felt that he did, clearly, because he had a granddaughter, and I always felt that having a relationship, having sex, having feelings, it was always within his nature. But I feel a lot of the relationship aspects that they've done in the new series were really wrong. And, the whole River Song situation to me was really wrong. It really played out so awkwardly and not realistic. And I didn't believe it at all. So that was one thing that I always just felt was really wrong and off character.
Yeah, well, I mean, he speaks from my heart again. You know, I don't want to go on a River Song diatribe, but yeah, I think that's probably my biggest contentious issue of the whole time. I can't think of trying to think of other things.
Well, the early moments of the Seventh Doctor always come to me.
Oh God, Time of the Rani.
Yeah. Falling over, all that sort of, and I also actually, do you know something that frustrates me? I know obviously Last Christmas did the dream thing and it did it well, but the ultimate foe, when you think the Doctor's escaped from the Matrix and he hasn't, and then at the end it seems that actually maybe you're still in the Matrix because the Valiard is disguised himself as the keeper of the Matrix. That again is something that doesn't sit right with me in Doctor Who. It annoys the hell out of me.
Well, I must admit, as a kid, I never saw it as him still being in the Matrix. After the Master had done that so many times, that it just, to me, was like another disguise the Valiard was using.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I think it was subtle enough you didn't have to take it in that route. Although, yeah, there's a good point. Perry's death should have been a death.
Oh,
there's
God,
one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Definitely, yeah.
I guess another one for me would actually be the end of Waters of Mars.
Right.
For two reasons. One, if you're going to do that, when you clearly know that there's another way out, like the Doctor knows, rather than mess with time, I can save these people's lives. I don't have to take them back to what they once were, but they can still live a life if I take them back like 50 years later or something like that, 100 years later, and just say, you know, here you go. Tell them it was a freak accident and now you're here. Because you can explain it with a time travel answer, or you can give them new lives rather than go ahead and completely distort time as you know it. So it just seemed to me like there was a better way out, especially after what we learned with Father's Day. He was taking quite a risk there that the Earth wasn't going to get devoured again. The second part of that, the reason why I think it wasn't really that great or didn't hit very well with me, was because if you're going to do such a great, big, massive change in the Doctor like that, where he realizes I've got all this power because the Time Lords aren't here, then you got to deal with it. And they never dealt with it.
No, they just reset him next episode.
Yeah, when you got to End of Time, it never happened. Whereas I felt End of Time, you see what he does in Waters of Mars, and then the very next story is called The End of Time. It seemed to me like they were directly related, and his actions had some great consequences, and that's how it should have played out.
Yeah.
So I always felt that that was wrong, because if you're going to do it, deal with it. If you're not going to deal with it, don't do it.
What they could have done, and what they probably should have done, is reverse Waters of Mars and Planet of the Dead. And have Waters of the Mars, Doctor gets all Valiard-esque, then Planet of the Dead, or a different story in place of it, Doctor is all Valiard-esque, and then End of Time, he starts his redemption and his regeneration as kind of a mini, kind of Pertwee-esque kind of regeneration arc.
I had remembered thinking when it happened in Waters of Mars that was what was going to bring the Time Lords back. There was going to be this massive change that the Doctor set in the timeline, that somehow was so big that it totally just messed with the time lock on a time war or whatever, and somehow was able to bring them back. Like, this massive change just rippled so incredibly, and that's what forced them to come back, and they were going to deal with him. I didn't think that they were going to be the bad guys. I thought that they were going to, like, deal with, like, you did this. Like, rather than be thankful that they're out of it, I thought that they were going to look at him and say, you broke this number one law. You know, you now have to pay for that again. And I thought that's how they were going to start the whole Moff era kind of thing. So I agree. Yeah. If they did do something like that, I like your idea with flopping those stories and adding another one where they do deal with it and then let End of Time be its thing. But they had to deal with it in some way. It just needed something. It was a great, if you're going to do it the way that they ended it, it seemed like he was in such a bad place. And then the explanation that we get is that he goes off and he gets married and does some other reckless things, and it's just kind of meh.
And meets his former self and his next self, and then forgets.
Yeah.
Did you know as well? Also, there is also another thing about all of that I don't like, or rather, I should say, it didn't sit right with me at the time, but now I do like, and that's the End of Time cliffhanger. At the time, really, really annoyed me. I thought it was so bloody stupid. But now I love it. I think it's marvellous.
Well, the multiple masters around the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very master. I mean, at the time...
Yeah, at the time I didn't think it was, but looking at it now, I do think it is. And also, when I watch it now, I'm in so much admiration for the amount of effort that they've gone to. Not just... Because I know there was a lot of John Sim masks. I'm not saying John Sim was in every single position filmed over the course of a year, getting everything right. Because I know there's a lot of John Sim masks, but John Sim did a marvellous job. But the whole focus on that cliffhanger works really, really well.
Yeah.
And it's one of those Russell T Davies cliffhangers as well that seem to go on for 10 minutes. Like the one in Army of Ghosts. It's like one of the longest cliffhangers of all time. Building up to the sphere opening and the alien invaders appearing. But in End of Time, it's admirable. No, it is.
And it plays that lovely Master Race line as well. Which...
Yes, yes. Can't argue with that.
But Sorry, go on. Go, Brian.
No, you're fine.
Go, B.
No, I was just going to say, I never had an issue with that cliffhanger, so I'm surprised that you did. I'm curious as to what the issue actually was.
Who are you talking to?
You.
Me? I just didn't like it at the time. I didn't think it was very masterly at the time.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Sorry. Anyway, James?
I was going to say, I was interested that a lot of people have cited Tennant again going, including the article itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still grates on me, and as I did this in the comments as well, is the self-putting wuss, the emo, those sort of remarks. It does rile me a little, because I never saw that with him at all. I don't know. I think the whole point of the Doctor is you're going to see different facets of him. And as someone said, well, you know, Eccleston wasn't like that. Why couldn't Tennant be like Eccleston? Why couldn't he just sort of man up?
Well, that's the point, isn't it?
You know, that's the point. And the point is, again, is that, you know, he is a man who feels the responsibility of genocide and a loneliness and a fear of personality death, which I think is a sort of really quite nasty, horrid thing.
Yes, I agree.
And yet people sort of condense it down. It's their opinion. I do respect that. But personally, I find that it undermines the point. I think that's what that upsets me a bit. I think you miss the point if you just think he's just being self-absorbed. You think you put yourself in that situation. You put yourself in his head. And people will say he's too human. You think, well, that's the whole point of the Doctor, is he's more human than human. He does what other humans should do. That's the sort of irony, isn't it? He'll go and fight for other humans where other humans will ignore the problem.
You know, I always boiled it down to the fact that, you know, if you looked at the classic series, most of the Doctors were, even though they dealt with some heavy stuff, they were having fun. Whereas by the time you get to Eccleston, you know, he believes that he just destroyed his entire race. He's living with this huge weight on his shoulder. Rose starts to bring him out of it. And even when he dies, he's kind of a little bit happy that, you know, I'm starting to change. And then when he becomes this new guy, he's this fun-loving guy. He still has the weight of the world on his shoulders. But that's why he doesn't want to go, because he doesn't feel like that last guy that he was, and he's concerned, you know, like I've just started to really like myself again. What if I don't, you know? And I think that's a huge thing. And I think that's huge for anybody. You don't even have to worry about changing your physical form. All of us go through that with life's turns that it throws at us, you know? So I never had an issue. I am surprised. I agree with you with how many people point that out and are annoyed by that.
Yeah, the 10th Doctor was a fun guy, but there was too much room in the TARDIS. Ah, hey, thank you. I did really just say that, didn't I?
Yeah.
Now, listen, a couple of weeks ago, terror struck Doctor Who fandom, particularly those fans in the United States of America, when they discovered that there was a strong possibility that Netflix would not be renewing its Doctor Who license. OMG! We are happy to tell you that you can now put your pitchforks down and close your online petitions. If you haven't heard already, Netflix have confirmed that they are retaining Doctor Who, although at the moment only up to Series 7 and various classics. They're also keeping Copper, Monarch of the Glen, Seasons 1 through 6, so you get Tom Baker in there, and Torchwood as well. Series 1 to 4. But they are losing Red Dwarf, MI5 / Spooks, Blackadder and Fawlty Towers. Now that to me, the fact that they're dropping stuff, that says to me people aren't watching Fawlty Towers and Blackadder in America. Brian, why would they? They're 30 and 40 years old. Can you give offer us any insight into that, Brian? Why aren't you watching ancient British comedies?
Well, personally, I watch the ancient British comedies. You know, I think it's a good question, because I think a lot of us here who would watch them remember watching them and growing up with them on PBS. And despite telling some people to watch them, I find if I tell somebody check out Blackadder, they don't understand it. But if I tell them to watch the IT Crowd, they laugh their butts off. You know, and I think it's just a different style of humor. And I think you either have to get the humor or you can't enjoy it. And I think that's what it comes down to. And Fawlty Towers, I know, is different than that. But I don't know, because if you're into Monty Python, you'd think you'd want to check out Fawlty Towers. But even then, most people I know, they're talking of more kind of modern British things than classics. I'm surprised about Red Dwarf, though, because I know quite a few people here who are into that, to be honest. So I'm surprised that that's not doing that well. For them to renew it, or whatever it is that makes them renew things.
I'm not sure what the situation is with the UK, because obviously we have Netflix in the UK, although we don't have Hulu. And it's possible that the same situation transpires here. I don't have Netflix at the moment, or Amazon Prime, so I can't check that. If you do know, dear listener, do by all means let us know what you believe the case to be. Brian, do you have Netflix?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Do you just have Netflix, or do you have other streaming services as well?
I only have Netflix.
Okay. What about you, James? You don't have either, do you?
No.
Because you're just a poor student.
Yeah.
Netflix is how I get to watch the majority of the British shows that I do watch, to be honest. So it's helpful for that. Not even just British shows, American shows. You know, I was able to catch, as I spoke about a couple podcasts ago, The Blacklist. I was able to find that on there, which I really, I'll tell you what I don't have. I have Netflix streaming. I have iTunes for if I really want to rent something. And I have my DVDs for things that I know about. And otherwise, you know, I learn about shows from word of mouth, because what I don't have is TV, in the sense that I don't have cable. And I don't even have a regular aerial for the TV. I don't watch TV. The only things I ever watch are on Netflix, DVD, or iTunes, really.
Although you do have a regular aerial.
I do have a regular aerial. Yes, good one.
Oh, thank you very much.
Hey! No, I do. No, so really, I mean, I don't... When I did have cable, I found that there were like a million channels with like five things to watch. So it really bugged me. And then honestly, I was actually just speaking with a friend about this yesterday, because he was telling me, he said, have you watched The Escape Artist? And I said, yeah, I have. I said, that's a great series. You should also check out Broadchurch. And then we just kept throwing TV shows back and forth at each other. And I stopped and I thought, wow, I said, this is amazing. It's like TV is getting good again. Because for a while there, it was all reality TV or just really bad action shows or something, you know. And now it seems like all of these great shows are happening. So I'm glad to have something like Netflix where I can check them all out in one go, because I found that I kind of, when I get in the mood for something, I kind of want to just keep watching it. So I like marathoning a show versus waiting a week for a new episode. But I will if I have to. Like I do for Doctor Who, obviously, and now The Blacklist, since season two is on. But I'm surprised there's so many good new shows out there, which is great to see, both in the UK and the US, as far as I'm finding. So it's really nice to see it changing, because you had mentioned a while ago that in this podcast, rather, that Russell had said that he felt TV was a better medium. And I have to agree. I've always felt that TV was a better medium. I always prefer that to movies. There's just more stories and more time with the characters that you enjoy.
Yeah. It's funny you should mention this, because you're saying about the rubbish drama that we used to get about 10 years ago or so. Now, post-Doctor Who, or rather pre-Doctor Who return, there wasn't much in the way of sort of genre programming or sort of like fantasy programming or anything in the UK. And after Doctor Who, you know, we got Primeval, we got Robin Hood, we got Merlin, we got, you know, that's now we've got Musketeers. We got, what's the other one? The one I'm actually thinking of, but there's another one. Oh, we got Life on Mars, of course. And we got Bone Kickers. Do you remember Bone Kickers?
I don't know that one.
Right. It was Julie Graham and Hugh Bonneville. And they were archaeologists. And it was all kind of pseudo-archaeology. Not pseudo. That's not the term I'm looking for, really. There is a term I'm looking for, and I can't recall it. It's basically archaeology that isn't real archaeology, like fantasy items, legendary items that looking for, like Indiana
CSI
Jones.
CSI meets Indiana Jones.
Yeah, that I don't think it was as technology as CSI was. I can't quite remember, but it was poor. It was very poor. And, you know, I'm not really going anywhere with this other than that I used to start calling things that weren't very good a load of old bone kickers. That's basically where I'm going with that. So Netflix. I should also add as well, I keep getting free movies on Google Play.
Right.
Yeah, last month, I was given the first Sherlock movie free, Sherlock Holmes movie free, beg your pardon. With Robert Downey Jr. and that other fellow, Jude Law. And more recently I got... Oh, it's a Liam Neeson film, but I can't recall which one it was now. They're just kind of... basically, I didn't have films. I had never purchased a film in either of those two accounts. They were separate accounts. And they gave me films. So if you're after free films, just set up a... And you don't care what it is, set up a Google Play account and just wait until they email you and tell you here's a free film and see what happens. Might prove useful to you. Shall we? We'll move on, and then I think it's recommendations time. We're not really going to move on. I'm just going to basically say that if you are interested in joining the Casterbris team, I don't mean the podcast team. There's enough of us here already. I mean the Casterbris team, editorial, for writing news, reviewing books and classic episodes, Big Finish, and I've already said joining the news team. It is still open. You can still join, or you can apply to join. Send us a good example of your work, and we'll go from there. There's a note in the show notes there. If you just click the link into there to read the article and find the email address and what you need to do, get in touch with us. We've had a lot of excellent candidates so far. So you must also be excellent. But we'd love to hear from you either way. Recommendations time, gentlemen. Can I just do this? I just want to make a noise. It made a lot more sense than most of the other noises I've made in this Derby's podcast with a K. Recommendations time. Who wants to go first? Shall I go first?
Go on, yes. You.
Okay, I'll go first. I've got two recommendations, actually. My first recommendation is the second Sherlock Holmes film, which I really enjoyed the other day, and I don't think it got great reviews at the time.
It's brilliant.
You enjoy it as well?
I do.
Yeah. I thought it was better than the first one by far, so I'm not
so
sure why. I'm a bit confused by the whole thing. I thought it was really good. Jude Law is fantastic in it as well. I know he was in the first one, obviously, and I've seen him in a few things over the years, but I've never really been able to get past the fact that he's Jude Law, whereas in this, I did. Mm-hmm. Game of Shadows, really, really good. And Primeval Series 2, which I'm watching at the moment, is continuing to be a bit more enjoyable than it was when I first watched it back in the day when it was on initially. Now, there's a reason for this, and I think the reason is that ITV used to air it at the same time as Doctor Who, but start it about 20 minutes early. So I'd watch the first 20 minutes of Primeval, then turn it over and watch Doctor Who, and rarely see the rest of those episodes of Primeval. I'm in the just approaching the finale of Series 2 of Primeval, and it definitely is a kind of area that I would like to see Doctor Who attempt to reinterpret, you know, just for a two-parter or whatever. And I'm, you know, properly with dinosaurs. Not mean like crap like Dinosaurs on a Spaceship or the Silurian two-parter from 2010, but, you know, proper weird stuff going on, Doctor investigating it, finding out that it's a gateway to the past and there's monsters coming through. Brilliant idea. Could easily be done. And I am going to, although I have really, really wanted to watch Blake 7 from the beginning to the end for a long time now, Kerry's convinced me that I have to watch Primeval first from beginning to end. So I am going to get to the end of that, and then it's going to be Blake 7. So they're my recommendations for this week. That's Sherlock Holmes, Game of Shadows, and Primeval Series 2. Who's next?
I can go next. I've only got one this week because it was pretty much what I was watching, but I just finished up Series 2 of The Fall, and it's really good. It's kind of, it stars Gillian Anderson, and then, you know, there's a couple new faces to me in there. There's some familiar ones, but a couple of new faces in there as well. But it's kind of like a Broadchurch kind of situation where rather than being a cop show where every week there's a new crime to solve, they are focusing on one kind of main crime, in this case one main killer. But what you get to see is, rather than try and figure out who the killer is, you get to watch the show from the cop's angle and the killer's angle. Like, you get to see him kind of going about his daily life doing what he does, and while the cops are trying to catch him. And it was a really good show. I really enjoyed season one some time ago, and I just finished series two this weekend. So yeah, I would recommend that. It's not a lot too. It's only, I think, what, 11 episodes. So okay. Well worthwhile okay. watch.
Okay. James?
Well, I'm removing myself from his heart after that. I am stunned. I thought the full series two was absolutely watchable but terrible after such a good first series. Sigh. Brian Terranova. But I like your heart, Christian.
Right.
Your Sherlock Holmes heart. That's pretty right. Good. I like that. I'm there with you in that one. I'm just going to go with Musketeers because
Troubles you?
It has troubles for getting good ratings, which is a shame because it is a very, very, very good show.
Okay.
And if you get a chance, watch it. Some very interesting color palettes they're playing with at the moment, British television, which looks really good in there. Lots, you know, the old joke of the teal and orange lighting effects that you get in movies. It seems like Britain's starting to try using teal, yellows and browns as costume colors. Ripper Street, as we said, did very similar, and I've noticed Musketeers is doing exactly the same. Seems to be very vibrant teal, brown and yellows. It's very interesting. So yeah, watch it.
Okay, good. Now, before we close,
but don't watch the full series two, watch the Musketeers.
Before we close, have you heard these X-Files rumors?
Yes.
What do you think?
It's not gonna happen.
If it happens, if it makes it to a series, I think Gillian and David will be in like two episodes, because what they're mentioning in the article is reboot, and that they want Jillian and David back. And I think, honestly, I think Fox could make a new X-Files series work because the premise can still work. People still want good sci-fi and monster stories and drama and so on. But I don't think either of them will come back full time. So I think they'll come back as a cameo, and it won't be a reboot, but it'll be kind of a CSI Miami kind of situation where here's the X-Files, the next generation, if you will. I'm skeptical of it, though, like James, and honestly, more so, I would like to see them do a movie or a mini series just to finish that colonization story and be done, rather than get a reboot or a refresh or a remake or a continuation. So yeah, I've seen it. I'm curious about it, but I'm not expecting much from it.
Okay.
Well, they're all
James.
Massively
why
busy.
Do you think so heavily that it won't happen? Though? I'm curious.
They're massively busy. Everyone.
Yeah.
Duchovny's maxed out. Anderson just has a plethora of projects. Spotnitz is massively maxed out. Yeah, Carter's just lost his show.
Right.
But I just can't see it coming together for those reasons. Everyone is just massively busy.
I think if it comes back, it's going to be more so, you know, Fox controlled, kind of like how they tried to do with season 9. And
yeah,
I think maybe they might get like Spotnitz or Carter to do like an episode or two to kind of help move them along. But I think the same thing with Jillian and David. I think it would be more so they would cameo. Or maybe get them the cameo like once or twice throughout the series. I don't see it becoming a series with them. As much as I would be glad and I would watch that, in all honesty, I just, like you said, they're both so busy, and I can't see the both of them wanting to come back to that after they both worked very hard to get themselves to where they are after
to reestablish themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't see it.
Plus you've had 10 years of it. And I know coming from a Doctor Who podcast, that sounds unfair. But, you know, it'd almost be like saying you've had 10 years of Troughton and Doctor and Jamie. Why not have more? When a lot of people would say, well, you've had 10 years. And I'm just not convinced that the people who want the X-Files back are after the concept. They're more after, a lot of them, I think, are after the chemistry. So, you know, and then if you take them out, you think, should you just do a new show? Is the X-Files more about those two than it is really about the concept, which is quite loose and lightweight that you could apply to most in the genre? So
Maybe they should do it the Melissa and Joey way and just give them a show where they live together.
Well, that's ultimately what I think a lot of fans would like. And I genuinely do. I think that is, you know, there's complaints after the second film. I think that there wasn't enough Mulder and Scully in that sort of way, because that's what a lot of them would like. But then I think a lot of Doctor Who and Rose fans would have liked a series where they sat in the TARDIS and made tea, you know.
Oh, don't. You get me angry.
People do get connected with the domestication and the fascination of the characters to a point where TV just can't deliver what they need, what they're after. Because it's.
Well, maybe we're boring. Wrong. Maybe the clue is in the name. It's the tea in TV.
The T-Files?
The domestication.
Oh, the domestication.
I don't know. I do think, and you know, this is something that has been brought about for me since Doctor Who came back, and bringing up that last X-Files movie as well. I do think that the modern kind of way of mixing so much personal drama within things like sci-fi or action films is kind of a death or a borderline kind of situation, because when the show becomes more about the characters' relationships than the thing that brought all the fans there in the first place, which were the monster stories, you know, and great, you know, great characters, of course, I think that's a big issue, because then what you have is you don't have the X-Files anymore. Yeah. You know, that there's no point to it anymore. Now, granted, they always had a very close relationship, and Chris Carter was very good about playing that very subtly and not giving too much away too heavily, because then once you bring them together, you have to take them apart, because that's what happens in all of these dramas. Whenever you bring two people so close together that they, you know, spill their hearts to each other, well, then obviously where can you go? That everybody knows how much they love each other. You can't keep telling stories with the two of them being all lovey-dovey. You got to tell stories where something breaks them apart, and that's something that I cannot stand. And that's why I talked about 100 not long ago, why I stopped watching that. You know, the show seemed like it was actually getting okay, you know, it was a rocky start, but it seemed like it was getting okay. And then they were bringing these two characters together, this guy and this girl who were down on the planet. And then, sure enough, the guy's girlfriend had to come from the space station and go down the planet. And that's when I had to turn it off and stop watching, because I can't be bothered with this. I don't really care about people's love lives. You know, these people are down on Earth in life or death situations. And you want me to sit here and go, oh, will she get together with him? I want them to get together. I can't do that. It's so boring to me. It's so overdone. You know, whereas if you bring me an X-Files story where these two main characters are trying to stop a monster killer and nobody else in the world is believing them except for these two people, and you know that they're right and you just wish the rest of the world would listen to them because this thing needs to be stopped, that's entertaining and that's interesting because there's an actual threat. You know, there's something to actually get involved with on a more immediate and important level in my mind, you know? So I don't know. I find a lot of this personal drama aspect is coming in too heavily in a lot of these things that we really enjoy.
Okay. I think if you are into that with the Mulder and Scully, X-Files 2 ended on a good note for them. So
yes,
as you say, bring them back by the very logic, as you say, they will have to be estranged in some way to create the drama.
Yeah.
So you take them away from their happy place to have them back. So yeah, if it came back, I'd support it, should I just say. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Okay.
Yeah, and if it came back, I mean, there's two ways. I agree with you. You'd have to split them up. But I think the other thing that you could do is if you did, for instance, I want to see just one more movie, as I said, that colonization movie, and that's it. But and I think you could do something really great with a movie with those two characters in that situation where you don't have to break up the relationship. You can show how strong these two characters are by splitting them up by other means. And the whole point of them not only trying to stop colonization, but of the film is to try and get back together. And that would be great. Because I do agree. I am actually glad how their relationship developed and how they grew to get where they are. I'm fine with all of that. I thought it worked really well. I just don't want to see anything pointless happen to it. And I don't want to see the series come back. Essentially, I don't want to see it come back as a cash cow for a studio. I want to see it come back for the right reasons and done well.
And on that note, just say Millennium, their sister show, Millennium's first comic is January the 21st. This week coming out. So there we go.
Have you been podcasting about that recently?
I think I've got there's a podcast tonight that I've been invited on to, which is to talk about that. So
podcast hall.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of this week's Casterbus podcast with a K. We will be back next week in some configuration of Unity. Until then, it's goodbye.